Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's Thursday, January the 25th, and your Ben Jarofsky Show starts now. Today on the show, Ben welcomes a brand new guest, Northeastern Illinois University professor, Gabriel Cortez. The Ben Jarofsky Show, a presentation of the Chicago Reader, chicagoreader.com for everything there is to know in the city of Chicago. If you want to know what to do, where to go, what to eat, what to drink, well, you might want to head to chicagoreader.com. If you're in Chicago or if you're going to Chicago, all those questions will be answered. And if you want more Ben Jarofsky, just head to chicagoreader.com/Jarofsky. That's J-O-R-A, V as in victory, S-K-Y.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Saying Ain't So, Paul! Thursday, and here's why. The Paul in that sentence is Paul Vallis. And I have just taken special delight in this just flurry of articles that have hit Twitter. I'm like, Ben, you're reading Twitter. Okay, shout out Frank. Listener Frank reads Twitter, so I don't have to, as does listener Pat and Pat Whalen. You know, I got a lot of people in my life that are on Twitter, so that I don't have to be. And God bless every single one of you. So this one is really funny. All right, let me just set the table, ladies and gentlemen. The Paul in question is Paul Vallis. You remember him. All the North Side liberals said, oh, I'm going to vote for Paul Vallis because he's got experience. North Side liberals, you're so weird. The people you fall for. You fell in love with Paul Vallis, of all people. Good God. I knew so many parents on the North Side in the 90s. They were so mad at Paul Vallis for some of the stuff he implemented with their schools and their kids when they changed busing schedules. Long, ancient story. Nobody cares. I'm not going to go down the path and repeat it. Okay? I'm just telling you how things change. There were so many parents. Oh, that dastardly Vallis. Fast forward 30 years later. We like him, Ben. He speaks to us. Then there's the issue is he a Democrat or a Republican? Now, many, many years ago when he began in politics, he was a Democrat. You know, he worked for Daley. That's Mayor Daley, actually. Richard M. Daley, youngsters. You're Daley. I remember the old man. He worked for Daley. So, you know, that means he's a Democrat. But then he started moving right. You know, oh God, he loves charter schools the way I love fried chicken. I mean, he loves charter schools the way I love the Chicago Bulls. He loves privatization deals and schemes. But he hates unions. Oh, my God. Particularly the teachers' union. So the man, yeah, he said on some talk show that he's a Republican. Remember that? He showed up at this extreme far right wing outfit out in Naperville, give a speech. You know, remember the anti-woke movement that they were trying to spread in the suburbs? Hasn't really worked out that well. Shout out Kelly Garcia for breaking that story. Sure looked like he was a Republican. But now he's running for mayor one-on-one against Brandon Johnson. And he needs Democratic votes, so he assures the people, city of Chicago, I am a lifelong Democrat. And he gets all of these Dems. What were you guys thinking, by the way, when you endorsed him to sign on that they believe in Paul, that he's a lifelong Democrat? I'm just going to do off the top of my head a list of some of them. Senator Durbin, hello, come on down. Remember that show? Come on down. Arne Duncan, come on down. Jesse White, come on down. Oh, my God. Walter Burnett. And then Tom Tunney, alderman of the 43rd Ward, just loved Paul Vallis. Okay. And they wanted to assure Northside liberals that not Paul Vallis was a lifelong Democrat, except for the part of his life where he's a Republican. Hence, then he's not a lifelong Democrat. And he supported a woman's right to choose, despite the fact that he spoke before this group that was notoriously anti-abortion. So, you know, I don't know. I guess they convinced Northside liberals to go ahead with it. You know, Chicago voters, not the brightest people in the world, ladies and gentlemen. I've said that more than once. And he lost, though. Okay. But no, don't feel sorry for him. He went to work for some right-wing outfit writing. I don't know what he does for the right-wing outfit. And he writes occasional editorials for the Chicago Tribune editorial board, speaking of right-wing outfits. And then yesterday, or I forget when it was, story broke. It was actually a promotion piece put out by the Republican Party of Illinois, or Chicago. And I will now read that this promotion piece. Welcome Paul Vallis. Monday. That was, I'm not kidding, folks. The headline is Monday. There used to be a commercial years ago showing my age where they go Sunday. I think it was. It was a drag racing in Wisconsin anyway. Former CPS CEO Paul Vallis hasn't been CPS CEO since like 2001, Republicans. I don't know. Has he done anything in the last? That's like calling me former, what would they call me? Former Evanston High School grad scholar. It's been a while since I've been at Evanston High School. Anyway, former CPS CEO Paul Vallis will be our guest speaker for a Chicago Republican Party fundraiser. A fundraiser for the Republican Party. Whoa, Paul, let your freak flag fly again. Okay, you're Republican freak flag. Hold on, ladies and gentlemen. Here comes a clarification from Paul Vallis. He sent out a tweet came out saying, no, unbeknownst to him, his name was used by a group having an event and he had nothing to do with it, didn't know about it, etc. Okay. And then Bulldog Greg Pratt, Chicago Tribune reporter, he called up the Republican Party. Oh, Greg, you're funny, man. Here's his tweet. The Chicago Republican Party has a different story. Quote, the nature of the event was fully explained to Mr. Vallis. So there's a statement from the chairman of the Chicago Republican Party that says, the Chicago Republican Party is disappointed that Paul Vallis has withdrawn as a speaker at our upcoming event. The purpose in inviting him was to hear differing views and create meaningful discussion on solutions for the critical problems facing our city in hope of finding common ground. Mr. Vallis was invited as a policy expert who is affiliated with the Illinois Policy Institute, not a politician. We have hosted other policy experts at past events. The nature of the event was fully explained to Mr. Vallis. So I don't know who to believe. If a Republican says it, does that necessarily mean it's a lie? There's always that, okay? You know, who should I believe? I am torn between two not lovers, feeling like a fool. You know who must really feel like a fool if they're paying attention? All those Dems in Chicago who endorse Paul Vallis. Durbin, Tawney, Walter Burnett, Jesse White, Anthony Beale, I see all you guys. Well, he really is a Democrat, golly gee. Come on, Chicago. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. At least you can laugh, I hope, at your strange foibles. All right. A man, a very patient man, has sat through their opening rant and rail. and he's a first-time guest to my show, Gabriel Cortez. Welcome to my humble podcast.
Hello, everyone. I say thank you, Ben, for having me, man. I'm really excited to just break bread with you. And in terms of what you're saying, I have a great friend, rest in peace, Magda Gonzalez, who would always tell me, in Chicago, it's not about who you know or what you know. It's about what you know about who you know.
Whoa, I didn't know where you were going with that, but that was good. I'm going to put that on a T-shirt.
I'll never forget it. I was like 14 years old when she said that, and she, you know, rest in peace, Magda.
What's her name?
Magda Gonzalez, she was from the neighborhood, queen of so many blocks. But I'll never forget that because that's true, right? In terms of Chicago, it's everybody knows each other and we got something on each other.
That is so true. It's about not just, well, If it's true about Chicago, it's probably true about the world. All right. So let's get down to business. And so first of all, shout out David Perdue. He came to me. He goes, you have to have my friend Gabriel Cortez on your show. He's got a lot to say, and you should just bring him on. And you know what? He's not steered me wrong, David Perdue. He has been a guest on my show many times. Great artist, great thinker, has a different way of viewing the world. And he was the one who told me about Andre Vasquez long before Andre was an alderman. Damien goes, you have to have Andre Vasquez on your show. So I don't know if Gabriel Cortez is going to use his show to launch a political career, but he's shaking his head no. So Damien tells me that you grew up across the street from him way back when in the 90s, I guess, or the 80s. And you've gone on to bigger and better things, maybe not different things, let's say. Right. You're a professor. Yeah. So why don't you introduce yourself, if you will, to my listeners. Go ahead.
All right. Well, my full name is Gabriel Alejandro Cortez Luna Canales, right? My friends call me Gabriel. My parents call me, my family called me Gabriel. But born and raised Westtown. I didn't know it was Westtown until the yuppies started moving in. Because they were like, for real, because we're like Chicago and Damon. We're from Chicago and Damon. And then I was like, where's this Westtown place, like in the mid-90s? But, you know, but born and raised, my parents are from Mexico, but Westtown is a neighborhood that rarely gets spoken about, right? Yeah. You know, diverse. I grew up with diversity, but it wasn't easy. I grew up on Chicago Avenue, 2135 West Chicago Avenue. We had a corner store in the middle of the block right across the street. It wasn't a corner store, right? But it was that type of life. But we grew up with Ukrainians, Italians, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans. Latinos were coming in during the 80s. We moved there in 81. I was born in 74 on Walcott and Huron, right? So that's where I grew up. In terms of what I do now, I'm a professor in educational leadership. I prepare school principals at Northeastern Illinois University. I also run, I'm the director of the Enlace Leadership Institute, which is a higher ed master's program, in particular looking to help elevate Latino students and become leaders in higher education, right? So that's what I do in terms of my job. But in terms of being a Chicagoan, Chicago's the middle of the world, man. And we have so many stories. I'm a historian in education. That's what I've been trained for. I feel black because there's so many stories, right? Our communities, I grew up in an area where it was gang infested. Like every other three blacks was another gang. The Spanish D's, the C-Notes, right? You had the Latin Kings, you had the Dragons, the Gents, the Vikings, all of that. So I grew up with, you know, both domestic violence, not in my home, thank God. My dad was a yeller, but not a hitter. You know, and I'm blessed for that because that was not too common, right, in disenfranchised communities. But in Chicago, in terms of domestic violence was rampant in my neighborhood. Also, substance abuse, right, and community violence, where it was not, normal to see violence, right? And that's what provoked me to become an educator. I want to do something about this, right? You know, along with many mentors and woman mentors who helped me along the way, I went to U of I, Urbana-Champaign, graduated from Prosser Vocational High School back in the day, 92, Bronze's mother, right? And, Westside, yeah, I went there, you know, just a little bit of Chicago history. I went to Prosser, even though I grew up on Chicago and Damon, because Wells and Clemente High School were my community schools. But they, you know, they were known for having fights, right, and riots. They would actually have riots, right? If you talk to people, hopefully sometime in the future, I'll do a study on that. But when I was in high school between 88 and 92, you would hear riots between Black students and Latino students, right, in different high schools, Bogan, mm-hmm. Washington, right, Farragut, especially Farragut. They would actually make it to the news, right? But you hear these other stories from people that you just know. And talking to people in Wells, they'll tell you, like, man, the second floor, the third floor, it was an all-out riot. You know, people throwing chairs, all of that. And so I went to Prosser, not for its what they have to offer, just because it didn't have a reputation of violence, right? And I will say this, like I feel so blessed because we were all cool in Prosser. It was a third Black, a third Latino, and a third white. And thank God we didn't have the similar type of issues, right? You know, I grew up in the neighborhood, West Town, Chicago, Damon, it was pretty anti-black. You know, you had the Shy West, which were, you know, Eastern European gang members, but they were fading away, right? But their gang sign was the asterisk. I mean, not the asterisk, the swastika, right? So you would see that in the neighborhood. Walking around. Then we also had the C-Notes, which is an Italian-American gang, and they were fading away as well, right? You had the pipeline of Italian-Americans going to Franklin Park, going from our neighborhood, Franklin Park, EP, Elmwood Park, all of that. So you see that transition. I was lucky because I was young at the time, so I grew up with that diversity. My two older brothers weren't so lucky because when we moved in to Chicago Avenue, they had to deal with the older white gangbangers. And people, like, if you're not from Chicago, you don't know white gangbangers, they're the worst ones. And they get away with so much stuff, right? And so I seen that growing up. My brothers had to learn how to defend themselves. But the funny thing about Chicago, in the 80s, everybody was fighting. But in the 90s, people were hanging out at bars and saying, man, what were we fighting about? The ones who survived. The ones who survived, right? Because not everyone survived.
Oh, wow. There's so much to follow up on with that one. But when you talk about tough white kids from Chicago, it reminds me of a story. Shout out Adolfo. He's heard me tell this story so many times. I love telling this story. So I went to Evanston High School, and I had a very sheltered life, Gabriel, compared to your very sheltered. I'll put that right out there right now. I didn't get into fights. I ran away from fights. I hate fighting. I hate punching. I hate getting punched. I'm like, I'm not getting into a fight. And I grew up around liberals and lefties, and they all said the right things. Okay. Whether what they did was a whole other issue. So that was my upbringing, very sheltered, suburban upbringing. At some point in high school, this young man moved to Evanston from the southwest side of Chicago, black kid, and became friends. We used to meet at the park at night, smoke reefer. And he told me, he goes, and I'm paraphrasing, he said he came from Kennedy High School, which is on the southwest side of Chicago. He goes, Benny, the white kids at Kennedy are not like the white kids in Evanston. These are different kind of white kids. I'm like, there's different kind of white kids out there in the world that I'm used to? He goes, these are tough white kids. You don't want to mess with these white kids. And I was like, okay, there's another world outside of Evanston, huh?
Sure is in Chicago. I mean, you know, and again, like one of our movies growing up was Bad Boys. I don't know if you remember.
Bad Boys. Oh man, goodness. What's his face? Sean Penn.
Cy Morales. Who played Paco, I think it was. But you know, in that movie, you see that, right? You know, Sean Penn playing that white gangbanger, and that's what we don't see today. You know, most of it because that type of second, third generation of white ethnic groups are no longer in the city as much as before, right? You don't really see white gangs in the city, at least I don't. But not as before. You had the Gaylords, the Popes, right? You know, you had...
All right, so I got to ask you this question. This is the other question I had. So when telling that tale, and now you're looking back from the perspective of a man who's almost 50, when you look back on your life and you see yourself now, you're a professor and you're teaching the future principals of Chicago. We'll get into public schools in a little bit. And you think of yourself and the neighborhood you grew up in the 80s. Really, you grew up in the 80s and into the early 90s. Do you ever think, oh, my God, if not for, like, I could have gone a different way. It could have turned out differently for me if I hadn't done X, Y, or Z. If I hadn't hung out with Damien, if I hadn't done this, that, I just throw Damien in there. If I hadn't done X, Y, or Z, it would have been turned out differently. Do you have moments of reflection like that?
Oh, yeah, all the time. You know, I'm a thinker, right? Like my mind's always going, not to say that I'm correct all the time, but I think back, and actually Damien, he was a big part. A big part. He introduced us to hip-hop. Back in the late 80s, right? We used to listen to hip hop on the radio, of course, commercial hip hop. But he was like, no, you need to listen to some Public Enemy, you know. And the thing that the reason he got in tune because he went to Whitney Young High School, right? You know, which has like a black culture, which people kind of like feed off, right? Which was great. And so we're like, you know, he would play these records and we were getting into the groove and he was always the critical one. You know, his parents were hippies, right? So they were social justice advocates, all of that. So he was the second generation and sharing that with us, right? So he's one of the first friends that I had that opened up my mind with a critical point of view. And I always, you know, I'll never forget that, right, about Damon. But in terms of how things could have gone another way, you know, I have two older brothers who I always say they're the ones, they're the reason why I'm a professor, right? My family supporting me, my brothers, they protected me in that neighborhood. People knew, whoever knew us, the family or just, you know, our group of friends, they're like, don't get Gabriel high or don't mess with him because, you know, Gerald Louis going to beat you up. Our own friends are like, man, we're not going to do anything with you, right? But because of that, I was able to focus in school and go to U of I, right? But there was a moment, Ben, and this is typical in Chicago neighborhoods, right? And I'm not saying everything's the same, but, you know, it's just typical. I had my chain stolen by, I think he was a gang member. You know, he thought I was a Sino, which is, the Italian gang. The Italian gang was actually mixed by them. They had Latinos in there and all that, right? He stole my chain. I saw him again. Then I saw him a third time, and my brother was with me, and he chased him. Caught up with him and beat him up in front of everybody on the corner of just past Damon in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I went and my brother was, this the guy? This the guy? He's all bleeding. I'm like, damn, it kind of felt like a slap shot when they was like, is it this one? And I was like, yeah, it's him, right? And he was like, punch him in the face. You know, I have him. He was bleeding. He was crying. And my brother was just like, punch him, like get your licks in. And I remember clenching my fist. And I was like, you got him already. Like, you got him. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm not trying to add to this. And I'm thinking if I would have swung, I probably would have liked it, right? Because I had the advantage at that given time. And I probably would have liked it. And who knows, if I wanted some more, right? So thank God I did not. And I always think about that because those are situations that I've seen in the neighborhood where you make one mistake and you just go the other way.
Yeah, go the other way. Wow, yeah. Glad you didn't make that mistake. All right. I wanted to talk to you about Black Hispanic or Black Latino relations in the city of Chicago and the so-called immigrant crisis or migrant crisis. I call it a so-called crisis because I actually think it's an opportunity. And I realize I'm the only person in the city of Chicago who views it as an opportunity. And so it's kind of a joke on myself. But since you mentioned education and your day job, I got to ask you this. The front page news in today's Sun-Times, I'll show you, I actually have a newspaper.
Right.
Has to do with this moment. We're at like this juncture in Chicago, politics and education, and the politics of education, where the Board of Education, which has been appointed by Mayor Brandon Johnson, is considering ending, as we know it, the charter school program in the city. And this, the charter school movement in the city of Chicago is been going strong for a little more than 20 years. Right. I remember it was Mayor Daley and Paul Vallis who got it going, and Arne Duncan, really became a cheerleader as well. And the Dems of Barack Obama loved charter schools. And the notion that charter schools were going to be different than quote unquote regular public schools, they were going to give parents choice, like your parents had a choice between Prosser, Wells, and Clemente. That each charter school would be run almost like it was an entrepreneurial endeavor and not an educational one, and they'd be free of having union contracts and unions. In my humble opinion, they became, that last point was the most important point for their supporters on the right, and the Republican Party embraced charters, particularly because they understood that you could destroy teachers' unions the more charters you have. So that, to me, is a nutshell of the history of charters. Choice is a very important concept in education, and destroying unions is a very important goal of the Republican Party. So they came together. And now it looks as though the Board of Ed, Gabriel, may pull the plug. They may not give charters 10-year contracts like the charters want, guaranteeing their existence for another 10 years. They may give them shorter contracts. Not clear what they're going to do. but they talk a different game. They're not wholeheartedly waving the flag for charters the way past board members who were appointed by Daley and Rahm and Lori Lightfoot did. So what's your general thought about charter school movement and where we're at? Go ahead.
No, and that's a great question. I mean, how much time do we have right now? Well, you know, so first, you know, for me, I agree with the city's administration where all public schools need to be equipped, right? But it's easier to say it than actually do it. There's a lot of politics. There's a lot of leaders in different, you know, communities are doing different things, right, that are not right. And I know that because I know people in CPS as well as the Park District, all of that, right? But in terms of what I have seen in communities, for example, the Noble Street Charter Network, right? They're one of the biggest ones. Mr. Milky, who established it and been got ousted for doing some shady stuff. I actually know friends who were his students, not only at Wells when he was there before, but his first graduating class. And so they would defend it to the end. Like, no. I have one friend, an handicapped fellow, who says, I have 9 brothers and sisters. I'm the youngest one, and I'm the only one that graduated from high school because I went to a Noble Street Charter, right? So I'm like, oh, damn, because I'm against charter schools. I'm like, it should be all public schools. And so what I've learned, different schools have built communities, right? Charter, public schools, community schools, et cetera, whatever. But in some of these places, they built community, and they have a system where parents know them. They get their students to colleges and, universities, other, areas. And I can't deny that. When I saw that, I have a good friend, Aide Chavez, who actually works for Noble. She's like, this is what we're doing. And I'm like, wow, I can't deny that, right? So it becomes different spaces. But in terms of what the cities are proposing getting rid of it, you have to have parent voice, and I haven't seen that. You have to have parents come in and say, look, this is what we want for our community, or be involved one way or another. To do a shift is going to take a long time. You can't do it too short, at least in my opinion. But in terms of that question of being private versus public, talking to my friend Aida, like, you're right. I go, I can't promise parents that's going to be better in this public school, right, in this community school, because we know there's a lot of corruption that has been taking place. Right. And it's not the new administration's fault, but it has a long history. Right. So parents, this is why parents go to the lotteries. I don't know if you ever been to a lottery for charter schools, but parents show up and, the price is right. That's what you were referring to earlier. And they're jumping up in joy when their kids are getting caught. The way I see that, they're not looking at it from a broader perspective like we are right now. They just want a better opportunity for their children. And they're
absolutely
hearing,
look at your parents.
Exactly.
Look at your story.
Exactly. And I agree, right? And so they're on survival mode.
This is my attitude about charters.
Yeah.
And get your thoughts on this. And I come from a very different perspective than most people in the world. I admit that. I got no problem with charters. No, I understand exactly what you're talking about. Like, you're a little kid. And you're not a big, strong kid, maybe, and your choice is Clemente, where there's blacks and Hispanics are fighting in the hallways. Farragut High, no joke, in the early 90s, ladies and gentlemen, before Ronnie Fields, before Kevin Garnett. And now I realize, as soon as I said the millennials, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So just forget I even said Kevin Garnett or Ronnie Fields, millennials, Z's. Oh, my God. Just forget I even said them. Right. But before... anybody over the age of 50 knows what I'm talking about, who Kevin Garnett is and who Ronnie Fields is and the impact they had on Farragut High. But, oh, my God, the stories coming out of Farragut, the fights between blacks and Hispanics, crazy stuff. So a lot of parents are like, I need an alternative. I need a choice. So I understand that. I truly understand that, Gabriel.
Yeah.
My problem with charters is they're cheap to their teachers. Right. You're so freaking cheap to your teachers. How are you going to promote a teaching workforce by being tight-fisted? These charter school operators would go, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get tough on teachers. We're going to make it. We're going to fire them. We're going to make them take tests to be a teacher. And then we're going to cut their pay and their benefit. What industry can you grow and develop if that's your attitude going in?
Right.
Okay. So no, that's terrible attitude. Number one. And number two, if the teachers want to have a union, let them have a union. Why are you resisting a union? Then they all, like, all of a sudden they turn into Elon Musk, Gabriel. They're like, we're entrepreneurs. Yeah. We're not educators. We have to have freedom. What? Freedom what? To pay your teachers dirt? Is that what your freedom is? Just to fire a teacher whenever you want to? Because Billy Bob's mom doesn't want the teacher to teach anymore. You hear what I'm saying, Gabriel? Yeah, so no, that is my problem with charters. Go.
Oh, and you opened that door, right? So, where do we see charter schools in white affluent communities, right? You know, you only see them in disenfranchised communities, mostly Black and Latino. So I totally agree with you on that in terms of the quality. For me, there's a great book called Why Do Corporations Keep Bashing Public Schools by Susan Ohanian. She wrote that earlier, maybe about 20 years ago, but breaks down this national movement, right? Where Ross Perot actually was one of the first ones to put money in Texas for private, for charters, right? So there's a long history to that. And to me, it's neoliberalism. You know, we're not taxing the rich. Right. We cut the taxes. So those funds are no longer going to schools, TIF funds in which you're the expert in. Right. Those funds are not going to schools. So we need to cut more and more so money could go elsewhere, because these communities they're disenfranchised. They can't do nothing about it. What you going to do about it?
I'm
being sarcastic because they can do something about it. And that's actually what my research is about. You know, I wrote my dissertation on the hunger strike for in 2001 for Little Village High School in Little Village.
Oh, speaking of Paul Vallis, I remember that hunger strike. I wrote about that. God, I've been doing this for a long time, Gabriel. Yes. Parents had to go on a hunger strike to get the Board of Education to commit the money to build a high school in Little Village, which at the time was the schools were severely overcrowded. See, that's a whole other issue. As a scholar of education in Chicago, you notice with demographic trends are constantly changing. So I've watched the Board of Ed sort of like arriving at an intersection after the accident has occurred, if you will. Do you follow what I'm saying? So like, particularly in the north side, Rogers Park, I'm not making this up, Gabriel, in the 80s, the schools were overflowing. So about, it took the board in like the late, early 90s, they started building additions to the Roger Park schools. Demographic changes. Roger Park schools aren't overflowing anymore.
That's crazy. And you know what I miss the most after the 95 reform of Paul Vallis is, you grew up in Evanston, the field houses, right? Like I went to Mitchell, which is right there, Ohio and Levitt, and we had a field house, man. That's where I learned how to play softball, the clincher, basketball, because it was open every day after school. Yeah. And just almost every school had one. After 95, they all closed. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was, and I hesitate to call it reform. I know it's what everybody calls it.
Right.
But what Gabriel's talking about in 1995, the state gave full power to Mayor Daley to run the public school system, and they called it reform. And that's when I first realized anytime anyone in the state of Illinois calls anything reform, look out, because it's usually deform. I gotta say this. In those late 90s, when you were already done with school, after you left public school, Mayor Daley was kicking in money to rebuild. Oh my God, there were playgrounds. They spruced up schools, and essentially what they did was they took the money they're supposed to be putting in the pension funds and spend it redoing schools. And then they called themselves fiduciary wizards because they figured out how to do this and then patted themselves on the back. And then Rand Paul Vallis is the guy who you should put in charge of the budgets and got the Chicago Tribune, Tom Tunney, and Richard Gerber to endorse him. Okay. Just saying, Chicago.
Paul Vallis, I call him Bernard Epton part two, right?
Yes. Wow. Were you born for that? Yes, you were. Okay. All right.
I actually went, Bernard Epton had a rally on the corner right across the street from Damien's house. And he gave us free hot dogs. I remember that.
Well, at least you got something out of that campaign, which is more I can say. All right. So your basic point with charters is that, in your humble opinion, you should not just pull the plug on them right now and then force thousands of parents and children to suddenly make an adjustment.
Right.
At the very least, there should be a, sort of a wrap up, if you will, before you have this radical change. Go ahead.
No, exactly. You know, democracy is not immediate. We know that. And we should know that from progressive. The mayor ran on a progressive platform. So, you know, being progressive, being democratic, it takes time, and we have to engage with parents. To me, the parents are and students are the number one stakeholders, right? So, you know, and they have different opinions. And Daley, the second Daley, he would say that. He's like, no, I appoint the board members because I don't want, you know, differences. I want things to go much more. He said that openly, right? But democracy is the opposite, where it's like, no, it's going to take some time because we got different. So own up to it. That's my advice. But I know it's not easy. I do want to comment that you said about Hispanic and Black folks, and, you know, tensions. When people bring up that conversation, I always say, it's not that the tensions are direct at each other as communities, because both communities in Chicago have, you know, issues within themselves. And when they do clash, I always say they're just spilling over. You know what I'm saying? Because the levels of trauma is high in both communities, you know? And that's really like one of my colleagues, Dr. Lance Williams, who's in the South campus at Coretta Center, he does his work in Black gangs in Chicago. And he's like, the majority of the instances that we hear today are over or not knowing how to resolve conflict, right? We have young, you know, folks who are traumatized with no type of mentorship, whatever, or programming, and they're just going off on little things, right? So to me, when we talk about tension, it's really more about both communities need these support systems. And when we say their tensions, then we create this divide, right? Because I know couples that are Black and Mexican and Puerto Rican, you know what I'm saying? They have kids. So there's love. West Side got love for everybody. You know, I'm talking about regular people, right? It's, you know, to me, it's the leaders, both in Latino community, Black community, in terms of like specific particular leaders who make comments, and people are like, you see, they only care about their own group. So I do want to comment on that. You have a group called Kumbalinks. I don't know if you ever heard of them. So they're great friends of mine, and they do great work across cultures in that way in Chicago, right? So I just wanted to make that comment because, you know, as a Latino scholar, our history and contributions to this society is never recognized. You know, we're always seen as outsiders, right? What we're seeing today, in my opinion, because the Black community is going down in terms of the population, they're being pushed out. We know that. The CHA, right? You know, they demolished the buildings and just like, hey, you need to go somewhere outside of Chicago. We don't care where. That's what happened. They're being dumped all over the state. So there's this fear, and then you have the Latino population growing. So it's a natural fear, in my opinion, right? Like, oh, what, you know, what about us? Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that now, you know, and it's legit. Like, I don't think that's not legit. It is legit because, look, you know, the Black community has been disenfranchised for so long.
Yeah.
But what I will say, right, is, you know, now, you know, Latinos are a third of the city. And it's a different narrative. But unfortunately, when we have two groups, people see it as a competition. And it should not be a competition. And let me add this real quick, because I know you want to make some comments. But in terms of histories, people don't understand that there was a Southern Underground Railroad for former enslaved persons that went to Mexico. Like, people don't know that history. You know, Mexico, the second president of Mexico, which is Vicente Guerrero, who's mulatto and Black, because he was a Black Mexican, but he was whitewashed in history. He abolished slavery in 1829 and welcomed free slaves, right, to come to Mexico, and we protected them, right? So those are some history that people don't know. So when they look at us as outsiders, like, no, we're connected. And that's what I've been focusing on in terms of the last 3 years of our connections and among both communities.
All right. So before I talk about where we are now, let's go back in time and get you to do some reflection here. And this popped into my head when you were going on that last riff. So let's be Monday morning quarterbacks. All right. Now, looking back for the perspective, the advantage of a college professor who's done a lot of reading and scholarship down through the years, and think back to the world that existed in 1988. When you entered high school, okay? And your parents, again, Mm-hmm. Wells, Clemente, there are fights. All right. It's a scary prospect for your parents to send you to one of those schools, or for you to even entertain going to one of those schools because of what you've heard, et cetera, and so forth. From your perch as a professor, a scholar, from the vantage point of what life has taught you, what would you have done if you had the power, if you were the mayor, if back in 1990, if it was Mayor Cortez instead of Mayor Daley, what would you have done to stop the fighting, heal the situation at Wells or Clemente?
And you said the perfect word, heal. With the knowledge I have today, or with the knowledge we had back then, because we have different approaches today.
Fair enough. So let's pretend you could go back. I'll set up a show that we could put for Netflix. So Gabriel Cortez, with your brain today, gets put into the brain of, let me do the math, 16-year-old Gabriel Cortez. Ooh. And all of a sudden you wake up and you're 16, but you got your 50-year-old brain. Oh, man, this show. Damien, you could do the graphic arts for this show, okay? So, yes, you have the knowledge you have today. Go.
So the first things is what they were doing back then, they would try to isolate the groups, right? Because it wasn't only Black and Latinos, but it was also gang sections that they were aware of. I remember this because Coach K from Wells, he was my brother's football coach. He was one of the main guys because he was a big guy to design strategies. But they were separating them like animals, right? Like, oh, this crowd over here, you know, third floor, this crowd over here, second floor. With the knowledge I have today and that I gained from other people's insights, my good friend Rick Miranda, who works for Build Incorporated, he actually is a gang interventionist and does circles, restorative circles with different gang members. And he says after several sessions, they see how much they have in common and they help build community despite the fact that they come from different gangs, right? So we were doing back then, they were doing the exact opposite of what we should be doing. They're separating everybody and making them more detached, like those people, right? I don't like those people. Whereas what I would have done with today's knowledge, definitely created circles with families, with you know, students of different, you know, communities or racial backgrounds, etc., and create that space. Back then, because when I went to U of I and I came back and I visited my former teachers, I had asked the students, what country are they from? Their families, right? Because it was all Latino students. Some were from Guatemala, this and that. And my teacher told me, she's like, you don't do that. We're all American. I go, I get it, but we all have different backgrounds. But with that type of approach, we're not really embracing the cultures of people where they come from, right? Today, we're doing more of that. So I feel like in the late 80s, there was no best practices in that sense whatsoever. And that's the first thing I would do, right? Second thing is really jump on the LLCs that were just implemented, right? Remember that? The you know, if people don't know, it was a citywide coalition of different Black, Latino, including white organizations that came together to you know, make that happen, right? But we know once the great Harold Washington, the great Harold, like my favorite mayor, when he passed, it wasn't supported the way it was supposed to. So those are two things that I would definitely have implemented.
Wow. And you know what they would have said to you back then? While we're making it, hey, get out of here.
They're like, restore your justice. I want to restore
that. You know, I'll restore this justice over your head. Right. And here's the thing. Any situation I've gone into, where you have people pouring into one facility from different backgrounds, whether it be a YMCA, whether it be a park district field house, whether it be a public school, whether it be a high school, whatever, you're having people from different backgrounds who hear different things at the dinner room table. Because this is the other thing that people... You talk about making myths, Gabriel. We act like that we haven't been grown up hearing all kinds of bigoted things put into our ear at our tables by our parents and older brothers. Let me tell you about, and fill in the blank. Okay. Right. And this is what the real talk, you know, and then fill in the blank.
Right.
Okay. Just because you're saying it doesn't mean it's real. You're just saying it. When you bring people from all those backgrounds together, it requires, like, really, how do I put this? Brilliant leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody in charge who could just, like, if in the perfect world, in the ideal world, it's Denzel Washington. You know what I mean? You ever see Return of the Titans? I don't know if you have.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the man. Everybody respects him. He commands so much respect, but just the way he walks through the hall, okay? But that's the ideal form that Hollywood and Disney put out there. But in reality, you need somebody with that kind of stature. And we don't respect that. Gabriel, go back to what I said about charter schools. They want teachers to work for cheap. How do you reward people in the world, Gabriel? You give them more money. So what are, like, a great park district leader? You're going to make a lot of money? You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, people make good. I mean, again, going back to what you know about who you know. Like, the rich people make great money and don't do much, right?
Yeah.
You know, they get these positions. And we know that about Chicago and other places. But in terms of leadership, we need, like, this is one thing that I don't agree with the current mayor. I love his energy. I love his ideas. I do want him to succeed. But what I haven't seen, he really hasn't brought up Latino leadership the way I would have to see. The only Latinos that have gotten positions are the politicos who are representatives who campaign for him, right? But when I'm talking about appointing seats for commissioners and, you know, other leaders or units in City Hall, the representation of Latinos is very low. And we're one third of the city, and that's something, you know, that's something to me is an issue, because we're seeing how it's playing out right now in Latino communities with this crisis, right? When I'm talking to immigrant groups or organizations, say, hey, how are you working with the city? They're like, we're not. We can't get a hold of anybody in the city, but we're helping families find places to live. And we're, you know, so they're doing the work, yeah, but they're just not connected. And to me, is, you know, you need to, this is why you need to really diversify the people around you, because you need people who know these communities, mm-hmm, who know ICER, ICIR. They've been doing this work for more than 20 years, probably, you know, so why aren't, I think they're in now. I know New Life is in now doing services at the new shelter on 26 and Pulaski. And that to me is like cool about time, because you Spanish speaking people, for all these people who came in who are traumatized, just the fact that they speak Spanish alone can be comforting, right? You know, just that alone. But of course, we want more.
All right. So help me out on this one. Why hasn't, I think you already answered this. Remember, the Latino community in Chicago is not a monolith. Yeah, Gabriel just said they come from all different countries in the world. So I actually answered my question before I asked it.
Ask the question.
Why hasn't the Latino community come together as one to say, we welcome you, Venezuelans. We welcome you, Spanish speaking brothers and sisters. Okay. Why hasn't that happened? And instead, the alderwoman in the 12th ward, man, they were booing her and jeering her. I'm like, I'm looking, is there, just today, the story in the paper, Brandon John Mayor Johnson saying, Pritzker, put more shelters in the suburbs. We don't want them in Chicago. Like, wow. Where are our aldermen? I forget how many Hispanic aldermen are in the city right now. Where are they? Where are they standing up to say, no, we want immigrants, Hispanic immigrants, to come to Chicago, and we will do everything can to welcome there. What's going on, Gabriel?
So in my opinion, right, I think, like, there's a few things before we even get into that, because one, we're not monotonous, right? We come from different, you know, countries. We come from different socioeconomic status backgrounds. There's a big difference even between someone from Mexico who comes from the rancho, which is the ranches, than someone who's Spanish descendant, you know, from Mexico City, who is affluent, right? So there's a lot of variety of who we are, and coming in with those type of political, you know, agendas, right, or philosophies. So we're not the same, but I think in the United States we get, you know, we like to think about things in the binary sense. It's either this or this, right? And like when you look at race, according to you know, the oppressors, they established if you have a drop of black blood in you, you're black, right? You know, that's the way we abide in this nation. In Latin America, they had a racial hierarchy, a caste system that the Spanish had designed. And depending on the mixture between African, Spanish, indigenous, even like Asian, you had over 16 different categories of how you were, you know, according to your features. And so in terms of binary, there's a full spectrum over here. And then when people argue, they're like, you know, are you black or no? And it's like my wife, she's Afro-Colombian. And she's like, oh, no, I'm not black. The black people live in Palenque. I'm Morena. Morena is like a different. And some people say that's being like she's not recognizing her blackness. Like, no, this is their system, how they grew up. And let me just say, both systems are messed up. They're both, you know, colonization systems. So we're arguing which one's better than, you know, I'm not even going to partake in that. But the important thing is that there's a different lens. And there's a wider spectrum of how we look at things. We're not taking into consideration, you see? And what I tell people in terms of Latin America, the grand narrative is the Atlantic trade of the enslaved, right? That came in from West Africa all to the Americas. We think it's just the United States. The majority went to Brazil and the Americas, right? And so that's our grand narrative, going into indigenous lands, and then being pushed over, right, by European colonizers. But then people like me, who's light-skinned, I'm a result of that. My grandmother has indigenous features, right? Mm-hmm. But she's been detribalized, so she doesn't even know what, you know, what tribe she comes from or nation. So that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. The question. So in other words, it's a community that's not really a community.
So it's not right. I mean, it's a continent.
What I'm talking about in Chicago.
In Chicago,
the Latino community in Chicago is a quote unquote community, but it's not really one community.
No, it's not, and there's different factions, right? So you have the Mexican community, which is about 60% of the Latino community. We're a third of the city. We're about 60%. The next group is about 9%, which is the Puerto Rican community. Right. Then underneath that, every group is probably about 5% or less. So Mexicans stand out. Right. And we always ask, like, what's going on? Why don't we have political leaders and we do. Chuy Garcia being one of them. But we should have more. Why don't we have that? And why don't we have this stance? I agree with you. This is to me. This is what my opinion on this. A lot of families are still transnational. Where they're not really from, you know, they don't see themselves being from here. If you ask any patriarch of the family, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to retire in Mexico. That's the plan, right? Make your money here, buy that big. And some actually do it, right? But that's the mindset. I think that has something to do with it. What I tell people in terms of Latinidad is like a lot of Latinos, either if they were the immigrants themselves or their parents or maybe even third generation, we have this lens of opportunity, right? And it's not just Latinos, it's immigrants. Because my boy, Dr. Steve Paris, he's like, hey, Gabe, my family's from Jamaica, and it's the same thing. Like we came here looking for opportunity, and then looking at the African-American community, like, oh, how come they're not working? So, you know, all immigrants do that. Am I justifying it? Hell no, right? But the different lens is the Black community is like, no, we've been here, and they're going to exploit you. We know. Right. This is not, you know, going to come back to you 100%, you know, just because we've been here. And whereas these new immigrants come in, they see it more as an opportunity and they don't necessarily advocate as harder. Yeah. Right. Right. And I tell people that all the time. I'm like, it's not to justify it, but it's a different lens. People want a good number of Latino males that I have seen go into business. Not necessarily like the humanities in terms of getting their degree. So people are just trying, like, I came here to make some money. I'm not trying to be this political or whatever. So that's my opinion on that. But then you also have Catholicism that's big in our community. I'm second generation. It's funny, when my dad had a stroke, the Champlain asked him, he's like, "Are you Catholic?" And my dad's like, "Sometimes."
Yeah, right now.
And yeah. He wasn't even joking. He was like, "Sometimes, right?" Yeah. But like, we're not closely tied to the church, but other families are. So when you have the conservatives say their slogans or whatever, it catches with them. But also the Dems, like, for example, Mayor Brandon Johnson, he didn't talk much about Latinos in his campaign. You know, he didn't say, all he talked about was the migrant crisis. And we have to understand, the recent migrants are completely different from the Latino community who's already here, right? So people think that just because they're covering the migrant issue, that's the Latino issue, that's wrong. One, we're the majority of CPS, 49%. And now more with this, you know, new students, right? We don't learn Latino history. We don't. There was actually a survey, a five essential survey in civic studies and CPS, and it found out that Latino students are the cultural group that least see themselves in the curriculum, right? And that is crucial. People don't understand either that the Latino history was cut off from us. So we're cut off from understanding our own history of trauma, wars. You know, I'm from the Rio Grande, which is the border area, right? I got family in Brownsville. I used to live in Brownsville, four blocks from the border. But like, learning that history recently, I'm like, oh, no wonder my dad was always pissed. Like, there was a lot of trauma in this region. People don't know that there was between 1910 and 1920, hundreds of Mexicans were lynched by the Texas Rangers, right? And I'm like, I wonder how much that, because, yeah, I'm going to admit, there is a lot of trauma, like my cousins, all of that, from the elders, you see it, but I never made that connection, right? Yeah. But this is why it's important to know that history.
Well, we seem to be going in the other direction. We're running out of time, but, I mean, I'm introducing a topic that could probably be an hour's worth.
Right.
But I've had this conversation many times with other guests, Gabriel, but Nikki Haley, who's running for president as a Republican, was not able to answer the Civil War question when posed directly to her. What was the cause of the Civil War? She couldn't bring herself to say that it was slavery. And so you talk about history and amnesia and the position of the Republican Party right now when it comes to American history is that, yes, slavery existed, but it was not necessarily a bad thing, and we should stop talking about it anyway, because this is the land of opportunity. We should send out a different message that all people are equal. If we could just get rid of wokeism and affirmative action, if we could just get rid of the one program that helps Black people the most directly, okay, we get rid of that, then all things will be equal. But that's the position of the Republican Party. That's the position, more or less, the Republican Party right now. So that people don't want to know history. Gabriel, right. In my humble opinion, your thoughts?
Well, you know, and it's sad because in the United States, geography and history is one of the lowest, least favorite subjects, and it's telling, right? We don't even know people on Honduras. What part of Mexico is that? Like, no, right? But this is what happens. Joaquin Castro made a great comment a few years back. He's like, nobody knows who we are, Latinos are, and it's actually dangerous. So we're seeing that. We're seen as outsiders. I mean, it's sad. I'm sorry. But like, during Black Lives Matter, Humboldt Park, Logan Square, you had Pilsen, you had Little Village. We had marches for Black Lives Matter. It's sad to see, like, you know, you have different Black communities chanting, build that wall, build that wall. And it's just like, wait a minute, what's going on? Right.
Oh, man, we all been brainwashed by Trump. Every single person in America has been brainwashed and gaslit by Trump. And it's like they won't even admit it. Yeah. You get what I'm saying? So yeah. Rather than have Sanctuary City put on the ballot so that the city of Chicago vote on it, Mayor Johnson and his allies say, no, let's keep it off the ballot because I think we'll lose.
Yeah, right now that's where it's going.
Yeah, they'll keep it off. We'll keep it off. So that won't change the attitudes. If this city is about to defeat a sanctuary city measure,
right,
those attitudes that would defeat it will exist even if you don't put it on the ballot. Do you follow what I'm saying, Gabriel? So we're just avoiding the situation, in my humble opinion.
Well, this tension is fabricated, right? Because why aren't we talking about the Ukrainians, how they're being taken care of? You know, there are more Ukrainian refugees than actually Venezuelans, but they're being taken care of by the federal government, right? They have SNAP benefits. They have Medicare benefits. Once they step onto this country, right, we know what's the difference. They're white, right? They come from Europe. Trump said it. He goes, we don't want migrants from poop hole countries. Right? You said that, so now we're following up on that, right?
So no, he said, Trump, when he – this is so twisted, man. He goes, Mexico, they're not sending their best people. Remember he said that? Mexico's not – and everybody in the United States going, yeah, yeah. And I'm laughing because, what immigrant was, quote unquote, the best person sent by any? You get what I'm saying? It's like no one is the quote. I don't even know what it means, the best. You know, it's such to see so many people buy into Trump's logic or illogic. That's the gaslighting of America. Go.
It's the narrowing of our politics, right? No one really knows what democracy is. No one knows what neoliberalism is. Ask people, they don't know what it means, right? And for me, like, I take pride in still being part of a working class immigrant family and engaging with folks that are regular people and academia, because in academia, they get lost on it. Mm. You know, they think that, you know, and you mentioned woke people. I love wokeness. Yes, we need to be woke, but we need to follow it up with work, because we have too many woke people on social media just making comments and trying to just call out people, but the work isn't engaging with folks. You have to engage. We need to learn how to engage with people who have differences. And I don't see that with the mayor's administration right now. And that's dangerous.
Yeah, we'll close with this. At the risk of being naive, and I know some of my listeners will say I'm tremendously naive when I say this, I do believe that formula you just said, I love woke, but we have to follow up with work, could best be illustrated by putting a sanctuary city on a ballot, because it would force the woke people of Chicago to go to work promoting and trying to win over public acceptance of their principles instead of running away from a public fight over that. So, yeah, I buy into what you just said. I'm probably going to steal that line and use it all the time. I will give you credit.
You got me on the show. That's my gift.
I love woke, but we have to follow up with work. All right, Gabriel, I'm going to close the conversation now, because anything else I could see you and I share love for the talking and thoughts and ideas. And I got a feeling that if I open up any more conversation, it's going to be another hour. So I'll just invite you to come back and continue the conversation, particularly as the election year unfolds. Take a look at, let's see, you know, how Latino voters are, what direction they're going. Are they going for Trump? You know, Trump bragging, I'm going to get all the Latinos and black people to vote for me, this, that, and the other thing, you know.
Well, we got one candidate who wants the Civil War and the other one who wants World War III. Which one are we going to vote for?
Oh, my God. Now you sound like Trump. Trump goes, Biden's going to bring on World War III. He says it so much, sometimes he gets mixed up. And he goes, he's going to bring on World War II. He gets all mixed up. Okay.
Right.
I meant World War III, okay? I didn't mean World War II. All right. Thank you very much, Gabriel. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me, Ben. I look forward for the next one.
Excellent. All right. That's Gabriel Cortez. I also want to thank producer Chris. He does an outstanding job. I think Professor Cortez will agree with me when I say, hey, Chris, give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. Peace and love, everybody.
And remember, you can always stay updated on previous Ben Jarofsky shows, Benny J bonus interviews, columns from Ben Jarofsky, and columns from so many other great reader writers at ChicagoReader.com. Follow Ben on Instagram at Benny J Show. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow The Ben Jarofsky Show on your favorite streaming and podcasting platforms.